Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Wendy Mogul, child psychologist and author of the best-selling parenting books, The Blessing of a Skinned Knee and The Blessing of a B-. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, it feels a lot like spring already, which is funny because it's still early February and we normally don't have actual spring here until, March. Actually, it's felt like spring since about New Year's. The fact that this has been the warmest and among the driest winters in history out west would raise questions about the speeding progress of global warming, were it not for the fact that last year was the coldest winter on record in these parts and the wettest and snowiest out west. Nonetheless, in this week after Tu B'Shvat, the Jewish New Year for trees that has a central ecological orientation, it's probably a good idea to remember just how strongly Judaism comes down on the side of preserving and protecting our environment. One of the great ecological accomplishments of the last century or so was the greening of the land of Israel by the Zionist pioneers, and Israel remains the only country in the world, the only one, to have more trees and forests today than it had 100 years ago. Only Israel is greener today than it was in the year 1912. That is the direct result of human effort by the Jewish National Fund, among others. In an age of rapid destruction of the natural world, in which the Amazon rainforest is being eaten up by development, in which the whole continent of Africa is experiencing severe deforestation, in which China is consuming its natural resources at an astonishing rate, it's important to know that the Jewish bias towards preserving and protecting the environment remains strong and primary. Bal tashchit, we are taught, do not destroy the natural world that God has given us. And so, to play us in on a pastoral theme, here's Nurit Hirsch's beautiful classic song, Bapardes Liada Shoket, In the Orchard, sung by Yehoram Gaon.
Bapardes Liada Shoket, Tzel Arbaim Viroket, Tzipur Shota. אשכולית תלויה עדיין בין החורף והקיץ ואני כמותה עוד אני בוסע לחפש אחרי האהבת חיי ואני יודע תמה העונה תמו נעוריי במרום חמה בוערת אבל פה עמוק הערב כמעט הסתה אם תתאי ושוב תבואי עוד אהבתנו פה היא ואני איתה עוד אני פוסע לחפש אחריה אהבת חיי ואני יודע
Classic Israeli song, Bapardes Liada Shoket, In the Orchard, for the week after Tu B'Shvat. There was an interesting note in the news, probably not surprising, but maybe very important for Jews today. With all of the political unrest in Russia, Russians are now reported to be leaving the country in droves. And, of course, there remains a significant Jewish population in Russia. With large-scale protests against Vladimir Putin's continuing power in Moscow, will there soon be another wave of Jews immigrating to Israel, which has a huge Russian Jewish community now, or here to America? Will this be the next Jewish immigration issue? Well, keep it in mind over the coming months. Well, there was other news besides the Super Bowl last week. In fact, there was great controversy involving our two Jewish guests of about 2 weeks ago, Nancy Brinker, the founder and CEO of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation. This hugely successful breast cancer awareness and research funding organization was engulfed in a public firestorm of criticism after it pulled its funding for Planned Parenthood's breast cancer screening programs because of a congressional investigation. Shortly after the story broke, and a tremendous amount of negative response over the weekend, the Komen Foundation reversed the decision. That was followed by the resignation of Karen Handel, who was hired as Komen's senior vice president of public policy just last year. Handel, a former Republican candidate for governor of Georgia who is deeply opposed to abortion, was largely believed to be responsible for promoting the change in Komen's policy. After first defending the decision to stop funding the various grants it gives to Planned Parenthood, Nancy Brinker's statement on the issue also showed a reverse in course. She said, "Susan G. Komen for the Cure's mission is the same today as it was the day of its founding, to find a cure and eradicate breast cancer. We owe no less to our partners, supporters, and above all, the millions of people who have been and continue to be impacted by this life-threatening disease. We have made mistakes in how we have handled recent decisions and take full accountability for what has resulted, but we cannot take our eye off the ball when it comes to our mission," Brinker added. The story is a little more complicated than it appears. The Komen Foundation in 2011 gave out $92 million in grants for breast cancer awareness, screening, and research. It gave Planned Parenthood about $700,000, which primarily went for local breast cancer screening, paying for about 4% of the screenings Planned Parenthood does, mostly for underprivileged women. This represented less than 1% of the grants that Komen gave out last year. The official rationale for denying funding to Planned Parenthood was that the Komen Foundation recently passed a policy that it will not fund any organization that is under investigation. The current investigation into Planned Parenthood is not a legal investigation conducted by law enforcement authorities, but a political investigation started by Republican Congressman Cliff Stearns of Florida. He wants to determine if any federal funds have been used by Planned Parenthood to pay for abortion work, which would be illegal under federal law. So far, nothing has actually been alleged and no charges have been filed, and Congressman Stearns says he does not know Handel and has had no contact with the Komen Foundation at all. This whole affair leaves a very bad taste indeed. The Komen Foundation has long enjoyed an excellent non-political reputation for its work on breast cancer and has support across the spectrum of American life. Nancy Brinker, who is of course Jewish, received an Eisendrath Bearer of Light Award at the recent Reform Movement Biennial Convention, its highest honor. I was there and saw it. She spoke very well. And in the wake of the initial decision, the Religious Action Center of the Reform Movement, among many others, urged her to reverse the Komen Foundation's decision, which they eventually did. Well, if there's any good news out of this at all, it is that Planned Parenthood has now received about $3 million in replacement funding from donors, about $2.25 million more than it would have lost from the Komen Foundation's pulled grants, and they get the grants back too. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg himself donated $250,000, $250,000 of that money. Maybe not a large percentage of his $20 billion of net worth, but still very generous. So ultimately, Planned Parenthood is coming out ahead. The Komen Foundation received its very first, very public black eye. And it's clear that the American public is not supportive of using charitable funding as a way to advance an anti-choice agenda. Ever have trouble with your kids? Wondering how to relate to young people today? Our guest, Dr. Wendy Mogul, child psychologist and author of the best-selling parenting books, The Blessing of a Skin Knee and The Blessing of a B-, can explain it all to you with great humor when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. People sometimes ask me if I ever go to other restaurants and try their pizza. The answer is definitely yes. In fact, the other day I went to another restaurant to sample their pizza. So how did it compare to Mama's? Well, first of all, the crust tasted sweet. By that I mean they added extra sugar to the dough. At Mama's, we don't add extra sugar to any of our food. The blend of fresh, natural ingredients we use makes our food taste, well, fresh and natural. Now there's one more thing I noticed about the other pizza. Based on the portion size and price, I paid about 1.5 times more for it than one of ours. In this economy, that's a pretty big deal. So I guess one reason I try other restaurants is that it makes me realize Mama's Pizza is one of the best. And that's a very sweet feeling. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Check them out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Wendy Mogul. She's the internationally acclaimed clinical psychologist and author of the parenting books, the best-selling The Blessing of a Skinned Knee and the new The Blessing of a B-. She is frequently consulted by journalists for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Better Homes and Gardens, and Parents Magazine for expertise on the dangers of overprotection, overindulgence, and overscheduling of children. That sounds so familiar. She contributes articles to all kinds of professional publications and has done many guest appearances on Drive Time and NPR radio shows and on TV programs like The Talk and The Today Show. And today, Too Jewish. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Rabbi?
I'm well, thank you. So, tell me about teenagers. I only have one, but I've got two more coming. What is it that we do wrong most frequently in parenting teenagers?
I think we can think of them like an etrog. They are oddly shaped, expensive, but very precious.
They don't smell like etrogim. Boys, too. Can promise you that.
We have this desire to kind of skip over this stage entirely, and we hope that they will go from adoring little children to junior statesmen with nothing in between. But it's a very important phase of life.
So, as the parent of an etrog, we find that teenagers can be the most extraordinary people and completely mature and highly penetrating and the most difficult, don't we?
That is true. And what they're doing is experimenting with different kinds of behaviors before they leave home so that they have an opportunity to learn from trial and error. And what I see parents doing so often is being a combination of panicked and naive. So we step in and try to over-control them, but then we ignore things that we should be tending to, and everybody gets kind of dizzy and alienated.
Speaking as a congregational rabbi, I have teenagers that come and tell me their life stories and pour out their hearts to me, provided they're not my own teenager. Is this a common experience for people who are professionals?
That is such an interesting question. I just spoke at the Union for Reform Judaism Biennial.
I heard you there, and you were quite entertaining and very wonderful.
Thank you. But the part you didn't hear was the next day, probably, which was the Education Summit, where I spoke about post-B'nai Mitzvah engagement and how difficult it is for congregations to keep young people engaged, and the tremendous importance of inspirational adults in teenagers' lives. They are very interested in spiritual issues, in pouring out their hearts, just as you described, to adults who will not be giving them a grade, who will not be deciding whether or not they're getting into College A or College B. And many of them lack for that presence in their lives.
We will talk much more and learn a great deal more about teenagers, I suspect, from Dr. Wendy Mogul when we return on Too Jewish.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife, Ann, are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch Yorkfel, please email us at 2jewishradio at yahoo.com or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2jewishradio.com. Download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts and like us on Facebook. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan is going May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in coming with me on this fantastic journey, email 2jewishradio at yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. You know, we continue to receive pleas for more Yiddish music from our Two Jewish listening public, and who am I to resist? And so here's a classic Yiddish song full of pathos and emotional schmaltz, a story about a little boy who begs his grandmother not to end the Shabbos and force him back to school where the mean rabbi awaits and all the tzoras of the week. It's called Bubben You.
Oy boben yo zog noch nit got fun Avraham Vos is dos mit dir heinter hall In a mariv seit is noch di sun nit vergangen Oy boben yo vart noch a war In a mori the sight is noch di sun nit vergangen Oy boben yo vart noch a war Zu sternit dem Frieden, dem heiligen Schabbes, die Stille, die heilige Ruhe. Me seht noch nicht scheinen in Himmeln kein Stern, oi wart noch a bissle zu. Der Gott von Avraham, spannt uns zurück ein in schweren Tage täglichen Jahr. Zu tragen dem Golis, dem Cheder, dem Reben, dem Wohl und die Deiges von Wohl.
That was Bubbin' You, a song to the grandmother by a little boy, as sung by, well, me, a few years ago on the Generation to Generation CD. We welcome our maven on Israel, the head of the Israel Center, Guy Gelbart. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So the obscure town of Beit Shemesh has been very much in the news over the last few months, in Israel, of course. Tell us a little bit about what's going on and why.
The story kind of exploded out into the media after a very unpleasant event where a young 8 years old, or maybe seven, depends which newspaper you read, American girl who made Aliyah to Israel with her family, a modern Orthodox family,
right,
that came to live in Beit Shemesh. She was walking down the street, and some ultra-Orthodox Haredim from a group that calls themselves the Sikrikim kind of attacked her.
Sikarii, the zealots, going back to the first century ancestry of that movement. Yep.
Right, which you know, literally means the dagger man.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the translation.
That's right.
And that group kind of attacked her. They called her names. They spat on her, telling her that she's not dressed modest enough.
It's a 7 or 8 year old girl.
Right.
Right.
For most Israelis, that was just over the top. That was, you know, that was the straw that breaks the camel's back. And Israelis were outrageous on this behavior. And it appears to be that in some groups in the ultra-Orthodox community that were for many years kind of separated from their surrounding. They were having their own school, their own education system, living in their own kind of shtetl communities. Their values about women's rights, about what is Jewish, have become so different, so far out from what the majority of Israelis, and I think most majority of Jewish people worldwide, conceive as Jewish values, that kind of bring a very tense, if not to say more, events on the ground. And that's a very big debate today on Israel. Basically, it's a debate about human rights. It's a debate about, on one hand, we believe that you need to keep women's right, and women are equal to men. They should be allowed to walk anywhere, to talk anywhere, to sing anywhere. You know, we had a woman prime minister. On the other hand, some people will kind of say, well, we do need to keep the right of those minority religious groups to keep their religion traditions. But having that said, in this case, we see where those values
are in conflict, right?
In conflict.
Yeah, although it's really hard to understand any Jewish system, ultra-Orthodox or otherwise, that would countenance spitting on a 7 or 8 year old Orthodox girl because you didn't think she was quite dressed modestly enough.
I must admit that I can't understand that behavior.
Right.
I think, and that's my personal view, okay? I'm speaking only for myself at this point, but I believe that this is our mistake as a society. As a society, on one hand, we do need to care about minorities. We do need to give them their rights.
To respect community rights, but also individual rights.
Exactly. We need to have the borders. We need to define what are the red lines that mustn't be crossed.
Right. Thanks, Guy. And, you know, this issue won't go away. There's a continual challenge of balancing religious needs with a secular society, but some basic derech eretz has to prevail. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's JANOS.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, not too long returned from Bulgaria. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Bulgarian Jewish community and some very interesting aspects of it over the last couple of weeks, mostly in the main cities and the important players. Let's talk about the countryside a little bit now.
So I spent, for better or for worse, a lot of this recent trip in the countryside. When I was posted as a diplomat in Bulgaria, I spent most of my time either in the capital or in a couple big port cities where there were sometimes official U.S. ship visits or other duties to attend or big fairs, occasionally in Plovdiv, which is the second city, which has always had a big community of both Jews and Armenians, interestingly. This time, the purpose of my trip was essentially wine tasting for one of my many part-time jobs that I juggle.
Tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
Well, in some cases, tasting Bulgarian wines can be tough, and in other cases, it can be very pleasant. But I visited a number of wineries, and there was only one in which the subject of kosher wine came up. And it came up in a very sort of bitter, aggrieved tone from the owner and or manager. It was never quite clear which, but sort of the boss on the spot anyway of this particular winery, who said that he had made X number of thousands of cases of two of his wines in kosher versions under what he thought of as rabbinic supervision, which may have been just the supervision of a mashgiach and not actually a rabbi. And you might want to explain to your listeners what the difference is.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a rabbi to be sort of an authorized person to check whether something's kosher or not. And even, you know, authorized is a vague term because there's lots of different kinds of kosher certifications. So mashgiach doesn't have to be really fully trained. They could just have certain specific knowledge. Many of them are very knowledgeable, more knowledgeable than many rabbis, but not always.
Right. And of course, each type of kosher certification requires a different level of knowledge and a different level of expertise.
Right, of course. And different companies support different people.
Right.
Certain rabbis have certain
Certain people hold by one little symbol.
Absolutely.
And others by another. And
correct.
This particular symbol was the circle K, which I don't know how high or low that is on the scale.
It's pretty good, but
right. But there are probably some people for whom it's not good enough because there always are such people.
Of course.
Okay. True. So in any case, this guy launched into a long litany of complaints about how he's got all this unsold kosher wine because he was in negotiations for a long time with somebody from another winery and he didn't realize it was a competitor. He thought it was actually somebody who was going to promote his wine in North America and not work effectively to keep it out. But then he was talking about the kosher wine market in Israel. Now, why any Israeli who cared about kosher wine would choose to import kosher wine from Bulgaria or anywhere else is beyond me because Israel produces a lot of wine, most of which is kosher, not all, and some of which is actually quite good.
Well, a lot of it's excellent even, right?
So that was a mystery for me. But the other mystery for me was his eagerness to exploit the market for kosher wines in Germany. I said, like, did you miss the fact that most German Jews were killed off and there's a very tiny market for this? He said, no, you're wrong. And it was kind of this interesting conversational impasse because, well, I think we have to finish this next week, but there were other aspects that were kind of basic to Jewish life and existence in history of which this guy, for an intelligent major international businessman, seemed totally ignorant.
You know, it's interesting what people know and don't know, what they think they know, particularly in the area of Judaism. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie and Moshe are arguing strenuously. Finally, Sadie shouts, "You're a schmuck! You always were a schmuck, and you always will be a schmuck. You look, act, and dress like a schmuck. You'll be a schmuck until the day you die. And if you ran a worldwide competition for schmucks, you would be the world's second biggest schmuck." "Why only second place?" Moshe asks. "Because you're a schmuck!" Sadie screams. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well, and don't be a... This week's Torah portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as nearly any other part of the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic Torah portions featuring some of the highlights in the whole of Jewish tradition, indeed of all religious history, Mishpatim sort of comes as a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land. And in the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle somebody else's property fairly. How to assess punitive damages for a guy who injures another person or destroys somebody's property. How to act when someone puts his or her property in trust with you. Laws of manslaughter and theft and damages. Well, if the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is just an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems so trivial as not to belong in the Torah at all. So, why is Mishpatim here? In truth, we human beings have no love of law or lawyers, but without laws and without enforcement, we wouldn't function very well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. And where anarchy reigns, justice can't. That's where Mishpatim comes in. We need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one very much. Judaism understands that if we are to be truly good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Interestingly, at the end of this week's Parsha, after all the rules and laws, these torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses, a personal revelation. It's really a change of pace for such a legally focused portion, but there's a lesson here. In this way, Mishpatim teaches us that we can only experience real holiness when we begin by respecting our fellow men and women, when we come to understand that we are all in this together, and that the way to God is actually through the ways we learn to work together, to trust one another. We must do this in simple, practical, daily ways by following decent rules for human interaction. Poet Adrian Rich put it best, "These atoms filmed by ordinary dust, that common life, freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine remembering, putting together, inch by inch, the starry worlds." Freedom and holiness are dependent on the little laws established here in Mishpatim, and we can achieve both when we learn to follow the best of them. When we come back on Too Jewish, child psychologist and best-selling author Dr. Wendy Mogul will solve all of your parenting problems once and for all. Find out how when she returns in a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side.
That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In an action that seems to have come out of the distant labor past, Israel's giant labor union, the Histadrut, initiated a general strike last week. It closed down Israel's public transport, seaports, museums, cultural facilities, universities, stock exchanges, banks, partially closed the airport, and stopped most government services. The dispute between the Histadrut and the Israeli government is over wages and benefits, but primarily over what we would call non-union labor here, and which they call outside contractors in Israel. The once labor socialist nation has had long periods now of relative labor peace, so this breakdown on negotiations for a new agreement is both surprising and distressing. The heart of the matter is that Histadrut wants the government to officially hire some 250,000 contract workers, cleaners and security guards and the like, whose working conditions are inferior to workers now directly on the government payroll. The finance ministry says it cannot take on so many new workers, but is instead offered to improve their conditions by raising salaries at least 20% and giving them more vacation time. Boy, you know, I cannot conceive of an American industry or governmental body offering to raise anybody's substandard salary by 20% today, or offering to give people more time off. The truth is that, compared to working conditions and negotiations here in America, unions in Israel are in a vastly superior bargaining position, and the economy is much better there than here. I can't really imagine American unions threatening to strike these days and having any impact, even while American jobs are disappearing and working conditions worsen and benefits dry up. I'm not sure that Israel having a strike is ever a good thing, or any place, but it does serve as a reminder that there are still places, like Israel, where labor is highly valued. It's just not that way in America now. Also in Israel, lifting a half-century veil of secrecy, Israel's Mossad spy agency is opening its archive to reveal the story behind the legendary 1960 capture of Nazi mastermind Adolf Eichmann. The Operation Finale exhibit, curated by a Mossad officer whose name cannot be revealed, displays never-before-seen items, names, and documents that led to Eichmann's capture in Argentina. It also discloses new details, such as how forensic experts identified Eichmann by his ears. Eichmann was in charge of implementing Adolf Hitler's final solution, the plan to exterminate the Jews of Europe. 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis in the Shoah and by their collaborators during World War II. The Mossad's exploits typically only become known when they, well, screw up. This exhibit instead tells a success story, maybe its first, greatest, and most dramatic one, the most comprehensive picture to date of the complex operation that helped shape the Mossad's image, bringing a top Nazi criminal to justice. This is the first time the Mossad had carried out a huge operation overseas, the curator said. It had to invent all this James Bond stuff in the process. This operation made the Mossad, the curator went on. It proved to itself and the whole world that it could pull off an operation at the end of the world with a variety of bodies, under all kinds of identities and with various technical and technological means. The Mossad's tactics and strategies may have evolved since then, but the exhibit was initially intended to remain classified. However, the curator discovered that the Eichmann story was so strong that we just couldn't keep this one to ourselves, even 50 years later. Among the highlights of the exhibit at the Beit HaTfutzot Museum of the Jewish People in Tel Aviv are the original file on Eichmann, codenamed Dybbuk, Hebrew for an evil demon, the briefcase with a concealed camera that took the first pictures of Eichmann in Buenos Aires, the fake license plates agents made for vehicles to track Eichmann, the gloves used to nab him, the needle used to sedate him, and the forged Israeli passport his captors used to smuggle Eichmann out of Argentina. In other news, last week, Russia and China prevented the UN Security Council from condemning Syria or calling for President Bashar Assad's resignation in spite of the atrocities committed regularly by the Syrian military against rebelling civilians. In the aftermath of China and Russia's veto on behalf of another autocracy, Syrian troops shelled residential areas of Homs, killing and wounding hundreds. Navi Pillai, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, criticized Russia and China for that veto. I'm appalled by the Syrian government's willful assault on the city of Homs and its use of artillery and other heavy weaponry in what appears to be indiscriminate attacks on civilian areas. Anti-Assad activists in Syria say that after an artillery bombardment, Syrian government forces are thrusting into rebel-held areas of Homs with tanks, and troops are firing rockets and mortars, leaving many dead, most of them civilians. Pillai, a former South African High Court judge, said it was extremely urgent for the international community to cut through the politics and take effective action to protect the civilian population of Syria. And Robert Cohen, who founded the Hudson News Shops at airports and other transit stations all around the world, making overpriced reading material available to everyone in a pleasant browsing setting, died last week in Florida. He took over a family newsstand business in the New York area and turned it into a huge newspaper distribution business, and then created the attractive shopping experience that has seduced so many of us travelers into buying books and magazines we don't really want over the years. When he sold it in 2008, there were 600 Hudson News stores all over the country.
L-U-V, Madonna, Y-O-U, you wanna?
I see you coming and I don't wanna know your name.
Madonna, star of last week's Super Bowl halftime show, has announced that her new world tour will start in Tel Aviv on May 29th. That's the day after Shavuos, for those of you keeping track. Israel has a special place in Madonna's heart as the best-known Kabbalah student in the world, and she finished her last tour in Tel Aviv a couple of years ago. My, how exciting. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Wendy Mogul, the author of the two international bestsellers, The Blessing of a Skinned Knee and the new book, The Blessing of a B-. She's a graduate of Middlebury College, completed an internship and postdoctoral fellowship in the Department of Psychiatry at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in L.A., has delivered over 500 speeches, including keynotes, at the meetings of all kinds of organizations, National Association of Independent Schools, National Association of Principals of Schools for Girls, Educational Records Bureau, National Association of Episcopal, I'm running out of breath here, and the recent Union for Reform Judaism Biennial Convention, which she took by storm. You know, you include so much Jewish wisdom in your books, which are charming and funny and yet convey a lot of Jewish information. How do you decide what to include? How do you do that?
I just troll my life for inspiration. So anything I read or hear or come across in Torah or someone's sermon, I try to connect the ancient and the modern, because my sense is that there is so much wisdom in our tradition that is unfamiliar to even very serious Jews about raising children at this moment in history. So my mission is to bring the old to the new problems.
You know, I think every generation feels that it's the hardest time to raise kids.
Yeah.
Certainly feels that way right now. Tell us, is that true?
One of the things that's hard right now is that adults are so anxious about the condition of the world. So the economy is worrisome. So much seems unsettled. We have this apocalyptic sense, and yes, that has been true throughout history, but we are now worrying about whether or not there'll be any planet left for our grandchildren. And we worry about the kind of education our children are getting. We take all of these global worries, all of these things we feel we have no control over, and we displace it onto the one thing we believe we can control, which is whether or not our child gets the good or better second grade teacher. And that works fine until they enter puberty. And then we find, and many parents feel betrayed, because children used to say, "Mommy, mommy, please lie down with me in bed till I fall asleep, and you're the best mommy in the whole wide world, and I love you so much." And then they put up a sign on their door that says, "Keep out, this means you." And our hearts get broken, and so we triply try to control things. And I do think throughout history, children have found their parents to be terrible nags and unenlightened, and that is normal, healthy, and good.
Yeah, I mean, I remember lines from, I don't know, West Side Story, which was, after all, really the 1950s, barely the 60s. You know, you don't understand me, my parents, you were never my age, that kind of a line.
And I remember from Bye Bye Birdie, kids, I don't know what's wrong with these kids today, kids who can understand anything they say, kids, they are irresponsible, disrespectful oafs, noisy, crazy, sloppy, lazy loafers. So that hasn't changed.
What's the matter with kids today? I remember that. So now that we've placed ourselves as old and unable to relate,
right?
There are some new challenges with kids. It does seem that they spend all of their time looking at their phones and breaking that. What do you do about that?
So, and that's one of the things that was so remarkable when I interviewed Jewish youth leaders in preparing to give my remarks at the biennial, how deftly and wisely they use social media to connect with kids. So this, and there was a wonderful quote from Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, who said, "Do not fear technology. It will knit the world together." And he said this 15 years ago.
Yeah, it was absolutely. He was undoubtedly visionary in the use of technology in the Jewish world.
Right. And so it is in some ways like having a very polite heroin dealer living in your child's bedroom, in his bedroom slippers, and totally taking over your child's life, the technology. And on the other hand, it allows for global unity and transmission of information that is quite magnificent. So as with everything, moderation and knowing your individual child's temperament, nature, and ability to exercise self-control is the position for parents to take.
I remember back in the early 80s when I was a cantor at Temple Beth Am in Los Angeles, encountering kids who had a ridiculous number of outside activities at a very high level. They seemed to be totally overprogrammed. That's 30 years ago now. And I see it at a much more intense level now. We do this with our younger kids. Are people doing it with their teenagers too?
Oh, it's wild with the teenagers. I was part of a survey of, it was a work-life balance survey of adolescents, and we asked them how much homework they had for each class, how many hours of athletic practice, how long it took them to travel from home to the practices, to their SAT prep course, and we put in about 15 minutes or so for meals and a couple of minutes for a shower, and it ended up being minus time, that there literally were not enough hours in the day for them to do all of these activities. So many of them sleep 6 hours a night, and they're still growing. And the new neuroscience is very enlightening about teenagers, because we now know that the period of adolescence lasts from approximately 8 to 29.
Mm.
It's far longer than we ever understood, because girls are entering puberty younger, and the prefrontal cortex of the brain of boys is not finishing developing until they are in their mid or late 20s. And the reason I mention this is, if you stress this developing organism, it does not have a chance to flourish in a healthy, vibrant way.
The whole question of teen engagement and staying connected to synagogues and confirmation, we manage it with some good success at my congregation, but it's always a competition with all the other activities. And you're not really competing with other synagogues, you're not really competing with other religious experiences, you're just competing with culture. How do you compete?
And this was something else that I learned from the youth leaders that I spoke to, which is, at their synagogues, some of the students are begging their parents to let them go.
Right. Yeah, it's not usually the kids. It's often the parents that are the problem.
And the parents are so panicked. And I always say to parents, please do not read that piece of pornography called the U.S. News and World Report Rankings of Schools and Colleges, because it gives you the idea that there are only 10 colleges. And the reason the selectivity numbers are so very, very low is because the students apply to so many colleges. So it's really a distorted picture of the landscape. There is a perfectly fine college for every one of these kids to go to. But we get, I think it's a combination of parents' intelligence and creative imagination, and then the news media that loves to scare parents, that makes us literally paranoid. And so we think there are only two positions for the kids, which is ahead or behind.
I want to thank Dr. Wendy Mogul for giving us some perspective on how to raise kids and teens. Her latest book is called The Blessing of a B-. It's available everywhere. Is there a website people can go to find out more about you and your work?
My website is wendymogul.com, M-O-G-E-L. And on my website is my 13-step program called Overparenting Anonymous.
I'll have to start subscribing. And I can certainly recommend it to my congregants. I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Holocaust survivor and author Ernest Michel, who reported on the Nuremberg war crimes trial as a survivor and has had a fascinating and inspirational life. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TwoJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singers Noah and Mira Awad, a combined Hebrew, Arabic, and English song, There Must Be Another Way, which was a Eurovision finalist song a couple of years ago and highlights a musical partnership and friendship. My friends, may you be blessed with a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
There must be